Good morning.
Let's let everybody get settled. No big hurry. All right, Mr. Frizzell?
May it please the court, John Frizzell for the Randalls. This is a first-party insurance case that was affirmed in part and reversed in part and remanded to the district court. We've raised three issues on appeal. The core issue is the first issue, which is whether the district court erred in granting summary judgment on the Prompt Payment of Claims Act cause of action. The two other issues that are raised flow from that. So I'll address the prompt payment issue first and whether the summary judgment was error on that issue first. The argument in that is that Travelers did not present evidence that they paid attorney's fees that would be owed under the statute upon proof that the claim, that they were liable for the claim and that they didn't meet the statutory death upon for payment of the claim. Whether they were liable for the claim, to establish that they didn't establish it, they didn't present evidence they paid any attorney's fees, which, because they hadn't. But in order to not be liable for those attorney's fees, they would have to show that the claim was not covered. And our position is that whether they were liable for the claim or not depended on an affirmative defense that the damage that the appraisal award found that was initially denied fell within an exclusion to coverage. And because under Texas law, an exclusion is an affirmative defense, the insurance company, Travelers, had the burden to prove at the summary judgment stage as a matter of law that they were not liable for the additional damage that was determined to in the appraisal. So to establish they were entitled to summary judgment on the affirmative defense, they had to establish that beyond pre-adventure. They had to establish each element of the exclusion, and as a matter of law, they had to prove that meet their burden of production and persuasion on the affirmative defense. But they have not. They made an argument that it was not covered, but they, because it's an affirmative defense, it would be their burden to establish it as a matter of law. And our position is that they didn't meet their burden of production and persuasion at the summary judgment stage in order to shift the burden to us to prove that the claim for the covered damage fell within some exception to the exclusion. Our position is that it's covered, and that it's their burden to prove it's excluded. If somehow they did prove it was excluded, then we're not arguing that, well, it fell within some exception to that exclusion. So that's the core issue, is whether summary judgment, absent a showing of payment of attorney's fees, or that they, well, absent a show, because they didn't pay attorney's fees, absent a showing that they were not required as a matter of law because the claim wasn't covered to pay those attorney's fees, that summary judgment was improper because they didn't meet their burden on the affirmative defense.
Before you get to the affirmative defense, don't your clients have to establish their claim?
They have to prove that a loss falling within the terms of the policy occurred. There was a fire. This occurred on the 4th of July, in the middle of summer. The air conditioning blew the smoke throughout the home. The policy provided coverage for accidental direct physical loss caused by fire and smoke. And so they didn't, there's no argument that there wasn't a fire, that the home wasn't insured and they weren't named insureds.
Now, the district court struck the response to your client your client's summary judgment response is untimely. Did your clients challenge that ruling?
I'm not challenging that.
So if you're not challenging the fact that the summary judgment response was stricken, then why aren't the arguments, what arguments are there that were raised in response? It sounds like there were no arguments raised. Isn't that a forfeiture of the issues raised?
No, on the prompt payment issue, because the summary judgment evidence that was submitted and acknowledged in the district court's order, the dispute wasn't about whether there was a loss. Was the additional damage covered? But there was a loss, so to prove that the additional damage wasn't covered, they would have to prove the exclusion applied. So because that's an affirmative defense, we wouldn't, the burden under the policy to prove a loss covered by the terms of the policy was met. That shifted the burden to the travelers to prove the exclusion. And the summary, the district court's opinion on the first summary judgment order and on the second summary judgment order included the facts that we're relying on to say that this was a covered loss. Therefore, it's their burden to prove the exclusion would apply.
So you're saying it doesn't matter that there was no response by the Randalls. The insurance company didn't meet its burden on the affirmative defense.
Correct. That until they meet that burden, we didn't have a burden to respond. It was their burden, given what the state of the evidence was and what the issue on remand was, this is being remanded to the district court on the prompt payment, which is the coverage issue. That until they established, not they had to meet the initial burden of production and persuasion to shift the burden to us to respond to that. I'm relying on Celotex and other cases in the circuit as well.
What does the record tell us one way or the other about whether Travelers was furnished all of the information that it needed and received it timely?
We are only challenging on appeal here the dwelling coverage. We're not challenging the contents. There is some argument about when did they get the information they needed for the contents. So we're not challenging that issue. But on the dwelling, as the district court's opinion on both the first summary judgment order and the second summary judgment order reflects, that Travelers adjuster Victor McKnight adjusted the plane with Blackman Mooring, who was the Randall's mitigation company, and that they were then, the Randall's released Blackman Mooring because they disagreed with Travelers' limitation of the coverage, and that they asked Travelers to come inspect. Travelers said, give us information to show there's more coverage. They didn't come inspect until that information of additional damage was provided. But then they said, well, there's no way to know what caused it. Was it fair to make the repairs that we did approve, or was it there at the time of the loss? But at the same time, had they gone and looked, that would have answered the question. And they knew the dispute was about the limitation of coverage. The travelers knew that the dispute that the Randalls had was the limitation of coverage. And they still, they didn't come look. And then they used the delay in not looking to say, well, there's no way to know. And as the district court said in both opinions in the district, on summary judgment, that travelers stated that, well, there's no way to know what caused it, if it was from the initial fire or if it was from failure to do the repairs that we did approve. But then that turns into the, under Menchaca, there's an argument that could be benefits lost under the independent injury rule if it was the way that they conducted the investigation of the claim that violated the statute that caused them to lose the benefits. But there was evidence that they had everything they needed when they looked at the claim after the initial fire, but then when they were told we have a, within a week or two that we dispute your coverage decision, they then did not go look. And they knew both from the Randalls and from their claim log includes an email from the Blackman Mooring contractor informing travelers why the Randalls disputed travelers' decision on the coverage. So they knew early what the dispute was, but they didn't look. And also under Barber Technologies, the Texas Supreme Court said that the appraisal process is not part of the insurance company's investigation of the claim. So it doesn't toll the running of the deadlines that they have to meet. So assuming, I argued in the brief, that giving them the benefit of the doubt, that when they did come look after several months had passed, well, when they came and looked again, they can't argue at that point. That's at the latest that they had all the information they needed when travelers did do the re-inspection. But our argument is that they had all the information the first time. But even if they didn't, they at least had it when they did finally conduct the re-inspection. And on we did raise on the whole statute, whether on the scope of remand, whether the statutory violations were within that. We raised that in a briefing in the district court that the court asked for on what was the scope of remand under the case. He denied our position. He rejected our arguments. Our position is that in the district court, in the first motion for summary judgment, and on the second motion, Travelers has never argued that there's no evidence that Travelers didn't commit any of these statutory violations. They've relied solely on the Texas Supreme Court's holding in Ortiz to say that absent a breach of contract, because we complied with the appraisal award and paid that. There can be no extra contractual damages absent independent injury separate from. And, you know, of course, we've briefed why we disagree with that, but I understand binding precedent in this circuit is, or in this court, is that that's what the Texas Supreme Court's opinion in Ortiz says. And that's why we've asked that if there is an issue about coverage, that the court should certify that question to the Texas Supreme Court. And the Travelers is correct. I had cited in my brief that this issue had been, the Texas Supreme Court had been interested in this issue in a case on Knott v. State Farm. That ended up getting dismissed. I did file a petition on the same issue in the Texas Supreme Court that has a fact pattern very similar to the case the binding precedent in this court on Morales v. State Farm. And the Texas Supreme Court has ordered State Farm to file a response to my petition. So that's going to be filed by early September.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Frizzelli. You've saved time for rebuttal. Mr. Frazier.
Good morning. May it please the court. Charlie Frazier on behalf of Travelers Lloyds of Texas Insurance Company. The court should affirm the summary judgment granted by the district court because the appellants have wholly failed on appeal to challenge the two independent grounds upon which summary judgment was granted. It's long been the law, the jurisprudence of this court, that when a district court grants a summary judgment on multiple grounds, that the summary judgment will be affirmed unless the non-movement appellant negates all grounds upon which the summary judgment was granted. The appellant's failure to challenge those grounds, both grounds, has three consequences. One, they have waived their right to appeal the summary judgment on the Chapter 542 claim, which is the only claim that the court granted summary judgment on because the court had decided correctly that this court's remand order in Randall 1 remanded only the prompt pay or Chapter 542 claim. So the first consequence is they waive their right to appeal. The second, and the case law, is that, again, decisions from this court, that the court is, you know, it can't be noticed. The summary judgment on that claim cannot be noticed or entertained by the court. And then thirdly, the affirmance of the summary judgment in its entirety is what's proper. Even if this court has held that even if the appellant here, let's say hypothetically, challenges one of two grounds, and the court opinion addresses that, and then decides that the district court was correct, but then the appellant does not challenge the second ground at all, this court has held that even if the district court were wrong, or even if we were wrong that the district court was right, the summary judgment still must be affirmed. This district court's judgment would still stand. So.
Well, that's also related to our general rule that we can affirm on any basis that appears in the record, even if it was not a basis that the district court relied on.
Yes, Your Honor.
You're saying that the district court did rely on it as an alternative basis.
Well, the district court, I'm sorry, relied on what as an alternative basis?
Relied on these alternate grounds that you're describing.
Well, there were only two grounds asserted. Travelers did not violate a deadline under Chapter 542, and alternatively, the deadlines never began to run because Travelers did not receive all items it requested that were necessary to determine the final proof of loss. Those are the only two grounds. And as the court pointed out, the response was stricken, so there was no response. Now, their brief, as my friend's argument today, is all about that we were claiming that we weren't liable under the policy because of a policy exclusion or because of the affirmative defense of failure to mitigate. You will not see that anywhere, Your Honors, in our motion. We never raise a policy exclusion, not one. And as for the affirmative defense, there was a dispute about the scope and extent of the damage spreading because they they fired Blackman Mooring, a well-known company that comes in and remediates, gets rid of smoke. They even do mold and all that. And then nothing was done. So we did say, no, if this loss has expanded and is more than what it was on July 5th, we came out there the day that we got notice, paid $10,000 in advance, we saw it, we inspected it, then you know, we reserve our rights. But we never effected that reservation of rights. We've never said, your claim is not covered, it's barred by your conduct, and we're going to challenge even the appraisal award because we're not covered. It's not covered. We're not liable. You know, liability is later after your appraisal, and we would have a right to continue and litigate liability if we wanted to, but we didn't. We paid the appraisal award timely. We didn't make the plaintiff to prove everything as far as what the appraisers found. But more importantly, those were the only grounds. And the issue one that, or the issue I should say two, is that they claim, appellants claim, that the district court's ruling on the summary judgment on the 542 claim was wrong because Travelers did not show that it paid attorney's fees. Well, attorney's fees is not a violation. That's the result of a violation. The summary judgment motion and the summary judgment itself was granted on the argument under the record that there was no violation. That has not been challenged. As we said in our brief, you will not find in the appellant's brief a statement about one payment that was late. But again, that just, pardon me, makes the point. They did not challenge, you'll see no challenge in their brief, that the court erred because the evidence did not conclusively establish that Travelers did not violate. The court erred because the record doesn't show that they didn't receive all requested items. That's not challenged. And there are 54 exhibits. The summary judgment record is at record 1541 to 1820. It's a lot of summary judgment evidence. And the district court's opinion says, it acknowledges that on this lengthy record, it is proven as a matter of law and established as a matter of law that Travelers did not violate a provision of the Chapter 52, 542 prompt pay statute, and that it never received all evidence or all documents requested that were necessary. That's in the motion. The court granted both grounds, and those two grounds are not challenged. And so, Your Honors, I'm happy to entertain questions, but on that argument basis alone, the court should affirm. And we'll stand on our briefs. If you don't have any other questions, I'm happy to entertain any questions you may have, but there's no challenge to the grounds.
All right, thank you, Mr. Frazier. Mr. Brazell for rebuttal.
The case was remanded initially because this court determined there was a fact issue about the prompt payment. And so we were back in the district court, and the issue was, were they liable for the claim? The parties agreed about the dates that they paid on the dwelling following the appraisal. There wasn't any factual dispute about that. So the record in the district court's original opinion in summary judgment, and then this court's opinion on appeal in remand, and the district court's opinion on remand that we're appealing from now, the issue was that there's a fact issue about the prompt payment, and the appraisal award was more than 30 days after the fire, and they didn't reinspect the property until, even though they knew of the dispute about the coverage, they didn't reinspect the property from early August of 2018, when they were aware of the dispute, until March 8th, I believe, of 2019. Or let me say that again. They were aware of the dispute in August of 2017, and they didn't reinspect until March of 2018. So the record shows that they knew there was a dispute as early as the first or second week, they knew there was a dispute about the coverage of the dwelling. Now, there's a bunch of disputes about when they had the information they needed about the contents, but as far as the dwelling, they knew there was a dispute, they didn't come look again. And then when they did look, they still didn't pay, and then there was an appraisal. So our position is that the record does establish that those dates that are not disputed raise that issue sufficiently to create a fact issue.
All right, thank you, Mr. Frizzell. Your case, both of today's cases, are under submission, and the court is in recess and under the usual order.